It will continue to increase in concentration with every waking minute that elapses. The longer you are awake, the more adenosine will accumulate. Think of adenosine as a chemical barometer that continuously registers the amount of elapsed time since you woke up this morning. One consequence of increasing adenosine in the brain is an increasing desire to sleep. This is known as sleep pressure, and it is the second force that will determine when you feel sleepy and thus should go to bed. Using a clever dual action effect, high concentrations of adenosine simultaneously turn down the volume of wake-promoting regions in the brain and turn up the dial on sleep-inducing regions. As a result of that chemical sleep pressure, when adenosine concentrations peak, an irresistible urge for slumber will take hold. Assuming you have a stable circadian rhythm and have not recently experienced jet travel through numerous time zones, in which case you can still have difficulty falling asleep even if you have been awake for 16 hours. It happens to most people after 12 to 16 hours of being awake. You can, however, artificially mute the sleep signal of adenosine by using a chemical that makes you feel more alert and awake, caffeine. Caffeine is not a food supplement. Rather, caffeine is the most widely used and abused psychoactive stimulant in the world. It is the second most traded commodity on the planet after oil. The consumption of caffeine represents one of the longest and largest unsupervised drug studies ever conducted on the human race, perhaps rivaled only by alcohol, and it continues to this day. Caffeine works by successfully battling with adenosine for the privilege of latching on to adenosine welcome sites, or receptors, in the brain. Once caffeine occupies these receptors, however, it does not stimulate them like adenosine, making you sleepy. Rather, caffeine blocks and effectively inactivates the receptors, acting as a masking agent. It's the equivalent of sticking your fingers in your ears to shut out a sound. By hijacking and occupying these receptors, caffeine blocks the sleepiness signal normally communicated to the brain by adenosine. The upshot: caffeine tricks you into feeling alert and awake, despite the high levels of adenosine that would otherwise seduce you into sleep. Levels of circulating caffeine peak approximately 30 minutes after oral administration. What is problematic, though, is the persistence of caffeine in your system. In pharmacology, we use the term half-life when discussing a drug's efficacy. This simply refers to the length of time it takes for the body to remove 50% of a drug's concentration. Caffeine has an average half-life of 5 to 7 hours. Let's say that you have a cup of coffee after your evening dinner, around 7:30 p.m. This means that by 1:30 a.m., 50% of that caffeine may still be active and circulating throughout your brain tissue. In other words, by 1:30 a.m., you're only halfway to completing the job of cleansing your brain of the caffeine you drank after dinner. There's nothing benign about that 50% mark either. Half a shot of caffeine is still plenty powerful, and much more decomposition work lies ahead throughout the night before caffeine disappears. Sleep will not come easily or be smooth throughout the night as your brain continues its battle against the opposing force of caffeine. Most people do not realize how long it takes to overcome a single dose of caffeine, and therefore fail to make the link between the bad night of sleep we wake from in the morning and the cup of coffee we had 10 hours earlier with dinner. Caffeine, which is not only prevalent in coffee, certain teas, and many energy drinks, but also foods such as dark chocolate and ice cream, as well as drugs such as weight loss pills and pain relievers, is one of the most common culprits that keep people from falling asleep easily and sleeping soundly thereafter, typically masquerading as insomnia, an actual medical condition. Also be aware that decaffeinated does not mean non-caffeinated. One cup of decaf usually contains 15 to 30% of the dose of a regular cup of coffee, which is far from caffeine-free. Should you drink 3 to 4 cups of decaf in the evening, it is just as damaging to your sleep as one regular cup of coffee. The jolt of caffeine does wear off. Caffeine is removed from your system by an enzyme within your liver, which gradually degrades it over time. Footnote: there are other factors that contribute to caffeine sensitivity, such as age, other medications currently being taken, and the quantity and quality of prior sleep. Based in large part on genetics, some people have a more efficient version of the enzyme that degrades caffeine, allowing the liver to rapidly clear it from the bloodstream. Footnote: the principal liver enzyme that metabolizes caffeine is called cytochrome P450-1A2. These rare individuals can drink an espresso with dinner and fall fast asleep at midnight without a problem. Others, however, have a slower-acting version of the enzyme. It takes far longer for their system to eliminate the same amount of caffeine. As a result, they're very sensitive to caffeine's effects. One cup of tea or coffee in the morning will last much of the day, and should they have a second cup, even early in the afternoon, they will find it difficult to fall asleep in the evening. Aging also alters the speed of caffeine clearance. The older we are, the longer it takes our brain and body to remove caffeine, and thus the more sensitive we become in later life to caffeine's sleep-disrupting influence. If you're trying to stay awake late into the night by drinking coffee, you should be prepared for a nasty consequence when your liver successfully evicts the caffeine from your system, a phenomenon commonly known as a caffeine crash. Like the batteries running down on a toy robot, your energy levels plummet rapidly. You find it difficult to function and concentrate, with a strong sense of sleepiness once again. We now understand why. For the entire time that caffeine is in your system, the sleepiness chemical it blocks, adenosine, nevertheless continues to build up. Your brain is not aware of this rising tide of sleep-encouraging adenosine, however, because the wall of caffeine you've created is holding it back from your perception. But once your liver dismantles that barricade of caffeine, you feel a vicious backlash. You are hit with the sleepiness you had experienced 2 or 3 hours ago, before you drank that cup of coffee, plus all the extra adenosine that has accumulated in the hours in between, impatiently waiting for caffeine to leave. When the receptors become vacant by way of caffeine decomposition, adenosine rushes back in and smothers the receptors. When this happens, you are assaulted with a most forceful adenosine trigger urge to sleep, the aforementioned caffeine crash. Unless you consume even more caffeine to push back against the weight of adenosine, which would start a dependency cycle, you are going to find it very, very difficult to remain awake. To impress upon you the effects of caffeine, I footnote esoteric research conducted in the 1980s by NASA. Their scientists exposed spiders to different drugs, and then observed the webs that they constructed. Those drugs included LSD, speed, amphetamine, marijuana, and caffeine. The results, which speak for themselves, can be observed in Figure 3 in the accompanying PDF. The researchers noted how strikingly incapable the spiders were in constructing anything resembling a normal or logical web that would be of any functional use when given caffeine, even relative to other potent drugs tested. It is worth pointing out that caffeine is a stimulant drug. Caffeine is also the only addictive substance that we readily give to our children and teens, the consequences of which we will return to later in the book. In step, out of step. Setting caffeine aside for a moment, you may have assumed that the two governing forces that regulate your sleep, the 24-hour circadian rhythm of the suprachiasmatic nucleus and the sleep pressure signal of adenosine, communicate with each other so as to unite their influences. In actual fact, they don't. They are two distinct and separate systems that are ignorant of each other. They are not coupled, though they are usually aligned. Figure 4 in the accompanying PDF encompasses 48 hours of time from left to right, 2 days and 2 nights. The dotted line in the figure is the circadian rhythm, also known as process C. Like a sine wave, it reliably and repeatedly rises and falls, and then rises and falls once more. Starting on the far left of the figure, the circadian rhythm begins to increase its activity a few hours before you wake up. It infuses the brain and body with an alerting energy signal. Think of it like a rousing marching band approaching from a distance. At first, the signal is faint, but gradually it builds and builds and builds with time. By early afternoon, in most healthy adults, the activating signal from the circadian rhythm peaks. Now let us consider what is happening to the other sleep-controlling factor, adenosine. Adenosine creates a pressure to sleep, also known as process S. Represented by the solid line in figure 4, the longer you are awake, the more adenosine builds up, creating an increasing urge, pressure, to sleep. By mid to late morning, you have only been awake for a handful of hours. As a result, adenosine concentrations have increased only a little. Furthermore, the circadian rhythm is on its powerful upswing of alertness. This combination of strong activating output from the circadian rhythm, together with low levels of adenosine, result in a delightful sensation of being wide awake. Or at least it should, so long as your sleep was of good quality and sufficient length the night before. If you feel as though you could fall asleep easily mid-morning, you are very likely not getting enough sleep, or the quality of your sleep is insufficient. The distance between the curved lines in figure 4 will be a direct reflection of your desire to sleep. The larger the distance between the two, the greater your sleep desire. For example, at 11 a.m., after having woken up at 8 a.m., there is only a small distance between the dotted line, circadian rhythm, and solid line, sleep pressure, illustrated by the vertical double arrow in figure 5 in the accompanying PDF. This minimal difference means there is a weak sleep drive and a strong urge to be awake and alert. However, by 11 p.m., it is a very different situation, as illustrated in figure 6 in the PDF. You've now been awake for 15 hours, and your brain is drenched in high concentrations of adenosine. Note how the solid line in the figure has risen sharply. In addition, the dotted line of the circadian rhythm is descending, powering down your activity and alertness levels. As a result, the difference between the two lines has grown large, reflected in the long vertical double arrow in figure 6. This powerful combination of abundant adenosine, high sleep pressure, and declining circadian rhythm, lowered activity levels, triggers a strong desire for sleep. What happens to all the accumulated adenosine once you do fall asleep? During sleep, a mass evacuation gets underway as the brain has the chance to degrade and remove the day's adenosine. Across the night, sleep lifts the heavy weight of sleep pressure, lightening the adenosine load. After approximately 8 hours of healthy sleep in an adult, the adenosine purge is complete. Just as this process is ending, the marching band of your circadian activity rhythm has fortuitously returned, and its energizing influence starts to approach. When these two processes trade places in the morning hours, wherein adenosine has been removed, and the rousing volume of the circadian rhythm is becoming louder, indicated by the meeting of the two lines in figure 6 in the PDF, we naturally wake up, 7 a.m. on day 2 in the figure example. Following that full night of sleep, you are now ready to face another 16 hours of wakefulness with physical vigor and sharp brain function. Independence Day and Night. Have you ever pulled an all-nighter, forgoing sleep and remaining awake throughout the following day? If you have, and can remember much of anything about it, you may recall that there were times when you felt truly miserable and sleepy. Yet there were other moments when, despite having been awake for longer, you paradoxically felt more alert. Why? I don't advise anyone to conduct this self-experiment, but assessing a person's alertness across 24 hours of total sleep deprivation is one way that scientists can demonstrate that the two forces determining when you want to be awake and asleep, the 24-hour circadian rhythm and the sleepiness signal of adenosine are independent and can be decoupled from their normal lockstep. Let's consider Figure 7 in the accompanying PDF, showing the same 48-hour slice of time and the two factors in question, the 24-hour circadian rhythm and the sleep pressure signal of adenosine, and how much distance there is between them. In this scenario, our volunteer is going to stay awake all night and all day. As the night of sleep deprivation marches forward, the sleep pressure of adenosine, upper line, rises progressively, like the rising water level in a plugged sink when a faucet has been left on. It will not decline across the night. It cannot, since sleep is absent. By remaining awake and blocking access to the adenosine drain that sleep opens up, the brain is unable to rid itself of the chemical sleep pressure. The mounting adenosine levels continue to rise. This should mean that the longer you are awake, the sleepier you feel. But that's not true. Though you will feel increasingly sleepy throughout the nighttime phase, hitting a low point in your alertness around 5 to 6 a.m., thereafter, you'll catch a second wind. How is this possible when adenosine levels and corresponding sleep pressure continue to increase? The answer resides with your 24-hour circadian rhythm, which offers a brief period of salvation from sleepiness. Unlike sleep pressure, your circadian rhythm pays no attention to whether you are asleep or awake. Its slow rhythmic countenance continues to fall and rise, strictly on the basis of what time of night or day it is. No matter what state of adenosine sleepiness pressure exists within the brain, the 24-hour circadian rhythm cycles on as per usual, oblivious to your ongoing lack of sleep. If you look at Figure 7 in the PDF once again, the graveyard shift misery you experience around 6 a.m. can be explained by the combination of high adenosine sleep pressure and your circadian rhythm reaching its lowest point. The vertical distance separating these two lines at 3 a.m. is large, indicated by the first vertical arrow in the figure. But if you can make it past this alertness low point, you're in for a rally. The morning rise of the circadian rhythm comes to your rescue, marshalling an alerting boost throughout the morning that temporarily offsets the rising levels of adenosine sleep pressure. As your circadian rhythm hits its peak around 11 a.m., the vertical distance between the two respective lines in Figure 7 has been decreased. The upshot is that you will feel much less sleepy at 11 a.m. than you did at 3 a.m., despite being awake for longer. Sadly, this second wind doesn't last. As the afternoon lumbers on, the circadian rhythm begins to decline as the escalating adenosine piles on the sleep pressure. Come late afternoon and early evening, any temporary alertness boost has been lost. You are hit by the full force of an immense adenosine sleep pressure. By 9 p.m., there exists a towering vertical distance between the two lines in Figure 7. Short of intravenous caffeine or amphetamine, sleep will have its way, wrestling your brain from the now weak grip of blurry wakefulness, blanketing you in slumber. Am I getting enough sleep? Setting aside the extreme case of sleep deprivation, how do you know whether you're routinely getting enough sleep? While a clinical sleep assessment is needed to thoroughly address this issue, an easy rule of thumb is to answer two simple questions. First, after waking up in the morning, could you fall back asleep at 10 or 11 a.m.? If the answer is yes, you are likely not getting sufficient sleep quantity and or quality. Second, can you function optimally without caffeine before noon? If the answer is no, then you are most likely self-medicating your state of chronic sleep deprivation. Both of these signs you should take seriously and seek to address your sleep deficiency. They are topics and a question that we will cover in depth in chapters 13 and 14 when we speak about the factors that prevent and harm your sleep, as well as insomnia and effective treatments. In general, these unrefreshed feelings that compel a person to fall back asleep mid-morning or require the boosting of alertness with caffeine are usually due to individuals not giving themselves adequate sleep opportunity time, at least 8 or 9 hours in bed. When you don't get enough sleep, one consequence among many is that adenosine concentrations remain too high. Like an outstanding debt on a loan, come the morning, some quantity of yesterday's adenosine remains. You then carry that outstanding sleepiness balance throughout the following day. Also, like a loan in arrears, this sleep debt will continue to accumulate. You cannot hide from it. The debt will roll over into the next payment cycle, and the next, producing a condition of prolonged, chronic sleep deprivation from one day to another. This outstanding sleep obligation results in a feeling of chronic fatigue, manifesting in many forms of mental and physical ailments that are now rife throughout industrialized nations. Other questions that can draw out signs of insufficient sleep are, if you didn't set an alarm clock, would you sleep past that time? If so, you need more sleep than you are giving yourself. Do you find yourself at your computer screen reading and then rereading, and perhaps rereading again, the same sentence? This is often a sign of a fatigued, underslept brain. Do you sometimes forget what color the last few traffic lights were while driving? Simple distraction is often the cause, but a lack of sleep is very much another culprit. Of course, even if you are giving yourself plenty of time to get a full night of shut-eye, next day fatigue and sleepiness can still occur because you are suffering from an undiagnosed sleep disorder, of which there are now more than 100. The most common is insomnia, followed by sleep-disordered breathing or sleep apnea, which includes heavy snoring. Should you suspect your sleep or that of anyone else to be disordered, resulting in daytime fatigue, impairment, or distress, speak to your doctor immediately and seek a referral to a sleep specialist. Most important in this regard, do not seek sleeping pills as your first option. You will realize why I say this come chapter 14, but please feel free to skip right to the section on sleeping pills in that chapter if you are a current user, or considering using sleeping pills in the immediate future. Chapter 3. Defining and Generating Sleep. Time Dilation and What We Learned from a Baby in 1952. Perhaps you walked into your living room late one night while chatting with a friend. You saw a family member, let's call her Jessica, lying still on the couch, not making a peep, body recumbent and head lolling to one side. Immediately you turned to your friend and said, "Shh, Jessica's sleeping." But how did you know? It took a split second of time, yet there was little doubt in your mind about Jessica's state. Why, instead, did you not think Jessica was in a coma, or worse, dead? Self-identifying sleep. Your lightning-quick judgment of Jessica being asleep was likely correct, and perhaps you accidentally confirmed it by knocking something over and waking her up. Over time, we have all become incredibly good at recognizing a number of signals that suggest that another individual is asleep. So reliable are these signs that there now exists a set of observable features that scientists agree indicate the presence of sleep in humans and other species. The Jessica vignette illustrates nearly all of these clues. First, sleeping organisms adopt a stereotypical position. In land animals, this is often horizontal, as was Jessica's position on the couch. Second, and related, sleeping organisms have lowered muscle tone. This is most evident in the relaxation of postural, anti-gravity, skeletal muscles, those that keep you upright, preventing you from collapsing to the floor. As these muscles ease their tension in light and then deep sleep, the body will slouch down. A sleeping organism will be draped over whatever supports it underneath, most evident in Jessica's listing head position. Third, sleeping individuals show no overt displays of communication or responsivity. Jessica showed no signs of orienting to you as you entered the room, as she would have when awake. The fourth defining feature of sleep is that it's easily reversible, differentiating it from coma, anesthesia, hibernation, and death. Recall that upon knocking the item over in the room, Jessica awoke. Fifth, as we established in the previous chapter, sleep adheres to a reliable timed pattern across 24 hours, instructed by the circadian rhythm coming from the brain's suprachiasmatic nucleus pacemaker. Humans are diurnal, so we have a preference for being awake throughout the day and sleeping at night. Now let me ask you a rather different question. How do you, yourself, know that you have slept? You make this self-assessment even more frequently than that of sleep in others. Each morning, with luck, you return to the waking world knowing that you have been asleep. Footnote: some people with a certain type of insomnia are not able to accurately gauge whether they have been asleep or awake at night. As a consequence of this sleep misperception, they underestimate how much slumber they have successfully obtained, a condition that we will return to later in the book. So sensitive is this self-assessment of sleep that you can go a step further, gauging when you've had good or bad quality sleep. This is another way of measuring sleep, a first-person phenomenological assessment distinct from signs that you use to determine sleep in another. Here also there are universal indicators that offer a convincing conclusion of sleep, two, in fact. First is the loss of external awareness. You stop perceiving the outside world. You are no longer conscious of all that surrounds you, at least not explicitly. In actual fact, your ears are still hearing. Your eyes, though closed, are still capable of seeing. This is similarly true for the other sensory organs of the nose, smell, the tongue, taste, and the skin, touch. All these signals still flood into the center of your brain, but it is here, in the sensory convergence zone, where that journey ends while you sleep. The signals are blocked by a perceptual barricade set up in a structure called the thalamus, a smooth, oval-shaped object just smaller than a lemon. The thalamus is the sensory gate of the brain. The thalamus decides which sensory signals are allowed through its gate and which are not. Should they gain privileged passage, they are sent up to the cortex at the top of your brain, where they are consciously perceived. By locking its gates shut at the onset of healthy sleep, the thalamus imposes a sensory blackout in the brain, preventing onward travel of those signals up to the cortex. As a result, you are no longer consciously aware of the information broadcasts being transmitted from your outer sense organs. At this moment, your brain has lost waking contact with the outside world that surrounds you. Said another way, you are now asleep. The second feature that instructs your own, self-determined judgment of sleep is a sense of time distortion experienced in two contradictory ways. At the most obvious level, you lose your conscious sense of time when you sleep, tantamount to a chronometric void. Consider the last time you fell asleep on an airplane. When you woke up, you probably checked a clock to see how long you had been asleep. Why? Because your explicit tracking of time was ostensibly lost while you slept. It is this feeling of a time cavity that, in waking retrospect, makes you confident you've been asleep. But while your conscious mapping of time is lost during sleep, at a non-conscious level, time continues to be catalogued by the brain with incredible precision. I'm sure you've had the experience of needing to wake up the next morning at a specific time. Perhaps you had to catch an early morning flight. Before bed, you diligently set your alarm for 6 a.m. Miraculously, however, you woke up at 5:58 a.m., unassisted, right before the alarm. Your brain, it seems, is still capable of logging time with quite remarkable precision while asleep. Like so many other operations occurring within the brain, you simply don't have explicit access to this accurate time knowledge during sleep. It all flies below the radar of consciousness, surfacing only when needed. One last temporal distortion deserves mention here, that of time dilation in dreams, beyond sleep itself. Time isn't quite time within dreams. It is most often elongated. Consider the last time you hit the snooze button on your alarm, having been woken from a dream. Mercifully, you are giving yourself another delicious 5 minutes of sleep. You go right back to dreaming. After the allotted 5 minutes, your alarm clock faithfully sounds again. Yet that's not what it felt like to you. During those 5 minutes of actual time, you may have felt like you were dreaming for an hour, perhaps more. Unlike the phase of sleep where you are not dreaming, wherein you lose all awareness of time, in dreams, you continue to have a sense of time. It's simply not particularly accurate. More often than not, dream time is stretched out and prolonged relative to real time. Although the reasons for such time dilation are not fully understood, recent experimental recordings of brain cells in rats give tantalizing clues. In the experiment, rats were allowed to run around a maze. As the rats learned the spatial layout, the researchers recorded signature patterns of brain cell firing. The scientists did not stop recording from these memory imprinting cells when the rats subsequently fell asleep. They continued to eavesdrop on the brain during the different stages of slumber, including rapid eye movement, REM sleep, the stage in which humans principally dream. The first striking result was that the signature pattern of brain cell firing that occurred as the rats were learning the maze subsequently reappeared during sleep over and over again. That is, memories were being replayed at the level of brain cell activity as the rats snoozed. The second, more striking finding was the speed of replay. During REM sleep, the memories were being replayed far more slowly, at just half or quarter the speed of that measured when the rats were awake and learning the maze. This slow neural recounting of the day's events is the best evidence we have to date explaining our own protracted experience of time in human REM sleep. This dramatic deceleration of neural time may be the reason we believe our dream life lasts far longer than our alarm clocks otherwise assert. An infant revelation. Two types of sleep. Though we have all determined that someone is asleep, or that we have been asleep, the gold standard scientific verification of sleep requires the recording of signals, using electrodes, arising from three different regions. 1. Brainwave activity. 2. Eye movement activity. And 3. Muscle activity. Collectively, these signals are grouped together under the blanket term polysomnography, PSG, meaning a readout, graph, of sleep, somnus, that is made up of multiple signals, poly. It was using this collection of measures that arguably the most important discovery in all of sleep research was made in 1952 at the University of Chicago by Eugene Ossorinsky, then a graduate student, and Professor Nathaniel Kleitman, famed for the Mammoth Cave experiment discussed in Chapter 2. Ossorinsky had been carefully documenting the eye movement patterns of human infants during the day and night. He noticed that there were periods of sleep when the eyes would rapidly dart from side to side underneath their lids. Furthermore, these sleep phases were always accompanied by remarkably active brain waves, almost identical to those observed from a brain that is wide awake. Sandwiching these earnest phases of active sleep were longer swathes of time when the eyes would calm and rest still. During these quiescent time periods, the brain waves would also become calm, slowly ticking up and down. As if that weren't strange enough, Ossorinsky also observed that these two phases of slumber, sleep with eye movements, sleep with no eye movements, would repeat in a somewhat regular pattern throughout the night, over and over and over again. With classic professorial skepticism, his mentor, Kleitman, wanted to see the results replicated before he would entertain their validity. With his propensity for including his nearest and dearest in his experimentation, he chose his infant daughter, Esther, for this investigation. The findings held up. At that moment, Kleitman and Ossorinsky realized the profound discovery they had made. Humans don't just sleep, but cycle through two completely different types of sleep. They named these sleep stages based on their defining ocular features: non-rapid eye movement, or NREM sleep, and rapid eye movement, or REM sleep. Together with the assistance of another graduate student of Kleitman's at the time, William Dement, Kleitman and Asarinsky further demonstrated that REM sleep, in which brain activity was almost identical to that when we are awake, was intimately connected to the experience we call dreaming, and is often described as dream sleep. NREM sleep received further dissection in the years thereafter, being subdivided into four separate stages, unimaginatively named NREM stages 1 to 4. We sleep researchers are a creative bunch, increasing in their depth. Stages 3 and 4 are therefore the deepest stages of NREM sleep you experience, with depth being defined as the increasing difficulty required to wake an individual out of NREM stages 3 and 4 compared with NREM stages 1 or 2. The sleep cycle. In the years since Esther's slumber revelation, we have learned that the two stages of sleep, NREM and REM, play out in a recurring push-pull battle for brain domination across the night. The cerebral war between the two is won and lost every 90 minutes, ruled first by NREM sleep, followed by the comeback of REM sleep. Footnote: different species have different NREM-REM cycle lengths. Most are shorter than that of humans. The functional purpose of the cycle length is another mystery of sleep. To date, the best predictor of NREM-REM sleep cycle length is the width of the brainstem, with those species possessing wider brainstems having longer cycle lengths. No sooner has the battle finished than it starts anew, replaying every 90 minutes. Tracing this remarkable rollercoaster ebb and flow across the night reveals the quite beautiful cycling architecture of sleep, depicted in Figure 8 in the accompanying PDF. On the vertical axis are the different brain states, with wake at the top, then REM sleep, and then the descending stages of NREM sleep, stages 1 to 4. On the horizontal axis is time of night, starting on the left at about 11 p.m., through until 7 a.m. on the right. The technical name for this graphic is a hypnogram, a sleep graph. Had I not added the vertical dashed lines demarcating each 90-minute cycle, you may have protested that you could not see a regularly repeating 90-minute pattern, at least not the one you were expecting from my description before. The cause is another peculiar feature of sleep, a lopsided profile of sleep stages. While it is true that we flip-flop back and forth between NREM and REM sleep throughout the night every 90 minutes, the ratio of NREM sleep to REM sleep within each 90-minute cycle changes dramatically across the night. In the first half of the night, the vast majority of our 90-minute cycles are consumed by deep NREM sleep and very little REM sleep, as can be seen in cycle 1 of figure 8. But as we transition through into the second half of the night, this seesaw balance shifts, with most of the time dominated by REM sleep, with little, if any, deep NREM sleep. Cycle 5 is a perfect example of this REM-rich type of sleep. Why did Mother Nature design this strange, complex equation of unfolding sleep stages? Why cycle between NREM and REM sleep over and over? Why not obtain all of the required NREM sleep first, followed by all of the necessary REM sleep second, or vice versa? If that's too much a gamble on the off chance that an animal only obtains a partial night of sleep at some point, then why not keep the ratio within each cycle the same, placing similar proportions of eggs in both baskets, as it were, rather than putting most of them in one early on, and then inverting that imbalance later in the night? Why vary it? It sounds like an exhausting amount of evolutionary hard work to have designed such a convoluted system and put it into biological action. We have no scientific consensus as to why our sleep, and that of all other mammals and birds, cycles in this repeatable but dramatically asymmetric pattern, though a number of theories exist. One theory I have offered is that the uneven back-and-forth interplay between NREM and REM sleep is necessary to elegantly remodel and update our neural circuits at night, and in doing so manage the finite storage space within the brain. Forced by the known storage capacity imposed by a set number of neurons and connections within their memory structures, our brains must find the sweet spot between retention of old information and leaving sufficient room for the new. Balancing this storage equation requires identifying which memories are fresh and salient, and which memories that currently exist are overlapping, redundant, or simply no longer relevant. As we will discover in Chapter 6, a key function of deep NREM sleep, which predominates early in the night, is to do the work of weeding out and removing unnecessary neural connections. In contrast, the dreaming stage of REM sleep, which prevails later in the night, plays a role in strengthening those connections. Combine these two, and we have at least one parsimonious explanation for why the two types of sleep cycle across the night, and why those cycles are initially dominated by NREM sleep early on, with REM sleep reigning supreme in the second half of the night. Consider the creation of a piece of sculpture from a block of clay. It starts with placing a large amount of raw material onto a pedestal. That entire mass of stored autobiographical memories, new and old, offered up to sleep each night. Next comes an initial and extensive removal of superfluous matter, long stretches of NREM sleep, after which brief intensification of early details can be made, short REM periods. Following this first session, the culling hands return for a second round of deep excavation, another long NREM sleep phase, followed by a little more enhancing of some fine-grained structures that have emerged, slightly more REM sleep. After several more cycles of work, the balance of sculptural need has shifted. All core features have been hewn from the original mass of raw material. With only the important clay remaining, the work of the sculptor and the tools required must shift toward the goal of strengthening the elements and enhancing features of that which remains, a dominant need for the skills of REM sleep and little work remaining for NREM sleep. In this way, sleep may elegantly manage and solve our memory storage crisis, with the general excavatory force of NREM sleep dominating early, after which the etching hand of REM sleep blends, interconnects, and adds details. Since life's experience is ever-changing, demanding that our memory catalogue be updated ad infinitum, our autobiographical sculpture of stored experience is never complete. As a result, the brain always requires a new bout of sleep and its varied stages each night, so as to auto-update our memory networks based on the events of the prior day. This account is one reason, of many, I suspect, explaining the cycling nature of NREM and REM sleep, and the imbalance of their distribution across the night. A danger resides in this sleep profile, wherein NREM dominates early in the night, followed by a REM sleep dominance later in the morning, one of which most of the general public are unaware. Let's say that you go to bed this evening at midnight, but instead of waking up at 8 a.m., getting a full 8 hours of sleep, you must wake up at 6 a.m., because of an early morning meeting, or because you are an athlete whose coach demands early morning practices. What percent of sleep will you lose? The logical answer is 25%, since waking up at 6 a.m. will lop off 2 hours of sleep from what would otherwise be a normal 8 hours. But that's not entirely true. Since your brain desires most of its REM sleep in the last part of the night, which is to say the late morning hours, you will lose 60 to 90% of all your REM sleep, even though you are losing 25% of your total sleep time. It works both ways. If you wake up at 8 a.m., but don't go to bed until 2 a.m., then you lose a significant amount of deep NREM sleep. Similar to an unbalanced diet, in which you only eat carbohydrates and are left malnourished by the absence of protein, shortchanging the brain of either NREM or REM sleep, both of which serve critical, though different, brain and body functions, results in a myriad of physical and mental ill health, as we will see in later chapters. When it comes to sleep, There is no such thing as burning the candle at both ends, or even at one end, and getting away with it. How your brain generates sleep. If I brought you into my sleep laboratory this evening at the University of California, Berkeley, placed electrodes on your head and face, and let you fall asleep, what would your sleeping brainwaves look like? How different would those patterns of brain activity be to those you are experiencing right now as you listen to this sentence, awake? How do these different electrical brain changes explain why you are conscious in one state, wake, non-conscious in another, NREM sleep, and delusionally conscious or dreaming in the third, REM sleep? Assuming you are a healthy young midlife adult, we will discuss sleep in childhood, old age, and disease a little later. The three wavy lines in Figure 9 in the accompanying PDF reflect the different types of electrical activity I would record from your brain. Each line represents 30 seconds of brainwave activity from these three different states. 1. Wakefulness. 2. Deep NREM sleep. And 3. REM sleep. Prior to bed, your waking brain activity is frenetic, meaning that the brainwaves are cycling, going up and down, perhaps 30 or 40 times per second, similar to a very fast drum beat. This is termed fast frequency brain activity. Moreover, there is no reliable pattern to these brainwaves. That is, the drum beat is not only fast, but also erratic. If I asked you to predict the next few seconds of the activity by tapping along to the beat, based on what came before, you would not be able to do so. The brain waves are really that asynchronous. Their drumbeat has no discernible rhythm. Even if I converted the brain waves into sound, which I have done in my laboratory in a sonification of sleep project and is eerie to behold, you would find it impossible to dance to. These are the electrical hallmarks of full wakefulness. Fast frequency, chaotic brainwave activity. You may have been expecting your general brainwave activity to look beautifully coherent and highly synchronous while awake, matching the ordered pattern of your, mostly, logical thought during waking consciousness. The contradictory electrical chaos is explained by the fact that different parts of your waking brain are processing different pieces of information at different moments in time and in different ways. When summed together, they produce what appears to be a discombobulated pattern of activity recorded by the electrodes placed on your head. As an analogy, consider a large football stadium filled with thousands of fans. Dangling over the middle of the stadium is a microphone. The individual people in the stadium represent individual brain cells seated in different parts of the stadium as they are clustered in different regions of the brain. The microphone is the electrode, sitting on top of the head, a recording device. Before the game starts, all the individuals in the stadium are speaking about different things at different times. They are not having the same conversation in sync. Instead, they are desynchronized in their individual discussions. As a result, the summed chatter that we pick up from the overhead microphone is chaotic, lacking a clear, unified voice. When an electrode is placed on a subject's head, as done in my laboratory, it is measuring the summed activity of all the neurons below the surface of the scalp as they process different streams of information, sounds, sights, smells, feelings, emotions, at different moments in time and in different underlying locations. Processing that much information of such varied kinds means that your brainwaves are very fast, frenetic, and chaotic. Once settled into bed at my sleep laboratory, with lights out and perhaps a few tosses and turns here and there, you will successfully cast off from the shores of wakefulness into sleep. First, you will wade out into the shallows of light NREM sleep, stages 1 and 2. Thereafter, you will enter the deeper waters of stages 3 and 4 of NREM sleep, which are grouped together under the blanket term slow wave sleep. Returning to the brainwave patterns of Figure 9 in the PDF, and focusing on the middle line, you can understand why. In deep, slow-wave sleep, The up and down tempo of your brainwave activity dramatically decelerates, perhaps just 2 to 4 waves per second, 10 times slower than the fervent speed of brain activity you were expressing while awake. As remarkable, the slow waves of NREM are also far more synchronous and reliable than those of your waking brain activity. So reliable, in fact, that you could predict the next few bars of NREM sleep's electrical song based on those that came before. Were I to convert the deep rhythmic activity of your NREM sleep into sound and play it back to you in the morning, which we have also done for people in the same sonification of sleep project, you'd be able to find its rhythm and move in time, gently swaying to the slow, pulsing measure. But something else would become apparent as you listened and swayed to the throb of deep sleep brainwaves. Every now and then a new sound would be overlaid on top of the slow wave rhythm. It would be brief, lasting only a few seconds, but it would always occur on the downbeat of the slow wave cycle. You would perceive it as a quick trill of sound, not dissimilar to the strong rolling R in certain languages, such as Hindi or Spanish, or a very fast purr from a pleased cat. What you are hearing is a sleep spindle, a punchy burst of brainwave activity that often festoons the tail end of each individual slow wave. Sleep spindles occur during both the deep and the lighter stages of NREM sleep, even before the slow, powerful brainwaves of deep sleep start to rise up and dominate. One of their many functions is to operate like nocturnal soldiers, who protect sleep by shielding the brain from external noises. The more powerful and frequent an individual sleep spindles, the more resilient they are to external noises that would otherwise awaken the sleeper. Returning to the slow waves of deep sleep, we've also discovered something fascinating about their site of origin and how they sweep across the surface of the brain. Place your finger between your eyes, just above the bridge of your nose. Now slide it up your forehead about 2 inches. When you go to bed tonight, this is where most of your deep sleep brainwaves will be generated, right in the middle of your frontal lobes. It is the epicenter, or hotspot, from which most of your deep, slow-wave sleep emerges. However, the waves of deep sleep do not radiate out in perfect circles. Instead, almost all of your deep sleep brainwaves will travel in one direction, from the front of your brain to the back. They are like the sound waves emitted from a speaker, which predominantly travel in one direction, from the speaker outward. It is always louder in front of a speaker than behind it. And like a speaker broadcasting across a vast expanse, the slow waves that you generate tonight will gradually dissipate in strength as they make their journey to the back of the brain, without rebound or return. Back in the 1950s and 1960s, the scientists began measuring these slow brainwaves. An understandable assumption was made. This leisurely, even lazy-looking electrical pace of brainwave activity must reflect a brain that is idle or even dormant. It was a reasonable hunch, considering that the deepest, slowest brainwaves of NREM sleep can resemble those we see in patients under anesthesia, or even those in certain forms of coma. But this assumption was utterly wrong. Nothing could be further from the truth. What you are actually experiencing during deep NREM sleep is one of the most epic displays of neural collaboration that we know of. Through an astonishing act of self-organization, many thousands of brain cells have all decided to unite and sing or fire in time. Every time I watch this stunning act of neural synchrony occurring at night in my own research laboratory, I am humbled. Sleep is truly an object of awe. Returning to the analogy of the microphone dangling above the football stadium, consider the game of sleep now in play. The crowd, those thousands of brain cells, has shifted from their individual chitter-chatter before the game, wakefulness, into a unified state, deep sleep. Their voices have joined in a lockstep, mantra-like chant, the chant of deep NREM sleep. All at once they exuberantly shout out, creating the tall spike of brainwave activity, and then fall silent for several seconds, producing the deep, protracted trough of the wave. From our stadium microphone, we pick up a clearly defined roar from the underlying crowd, followed by a long breath pause. Realizing that the rhythmic incantare of deep NREM slow-wave sleep was actually a highly active, meticulously coordinated state of cerebral unity, scientists were forced to abandon any cursory notions of deep sleep as a state of semi-hibernation or dull stupor. Understanding this stunning electrical harmony, which ripples across the surface of your brain hundreds of times each night, also helps explain your loss of external consciousness. It starts below the surface of the brain, within the thalamus. Recall that as we fall asleep, the thalamus, the sensory gate, seated deep in the middle of the brain, blocks the transfer of perceptual signals, sound, sight, touch, etc., up to the top of the brain or the cortex. By severing perceptual ties with the outside world, not only do we lose our sense of consciousness, explaining why we do not dream in deep NREM sleep, nor do we keep explicit track of time. This also allows the cortex to relax into its default mode of functioning. That default mode is what we call deep slow-wave sleep. It is an active, deliberate, but highly synchronous state of brain activity. It is a near state of nocturnal cerebral meditation, though I should note that it is very different from the brainwave activity of waking meditative states. In this shamanistic state of deep NREM sleep can be found a veritable treasure trove of mental and physical benefits for your brain and body, respectively. A bounty that we will fully explore in Chapter 6. However, one brain benefit, the saving of memories, deserves further mention at this moment in our story, as it serves as an elegant example of what those deep, slow brainwaves are capable of. Have you ever taken a long road trip in your car and noticed that at some point in the journey, the FM radio stations you've been listening to begin dropping out in signal strength? In contrast, AM radio stations remain solid. Perhaps you've driven to a remote location and tried and failed to find a new FM radio station. Switch over to the AM band, however, and several broadcasting channels are still available. The explanation lies in the radio waves themselves, including the two different speeds of the FM and AM transmissions. FM uses faster frequency radio waves that go up and down many more times per second than AM radio waves. One advantage of FM radio waves is that they can carry higher, richer loads of information, and hence they sound better. But there's a big disadvantage. FM waves run out of steam quickly, like a muscle-bound sprinter who can only cover short distances. AM broadcasts employ a much slower, longer radio wave, akin to a lean long-distance runner, while AM radio waves cannot match the muscular, dynamic quality of FM radio. The pedestrian pace of AM radio waves gives them the ability to cover vast distances with less fade. Longer-range broadcasts are therefore possible with the slow waves of AM radio, allowing far-reaching communication between very distant geographic locations. As your brain shifts from the fast frequency activity of waking to the slower, more measured pattern of deep NREM sleep, the very same long-range communication advantage becomes possible. The steady, slow, synchronous waves that sweep across the brain during deep sleep open up communication possibilities between distant regions of the brain, allowing them to collaboratively send and receive their different repositories of stored experience. In this regard, you can think of each individual slow wave of NREM sleep as a courier, able to carry packets of information between different anatomical brain centers. One benefit of these traveling deep sleep brain waves is a file transfer process. Each night, the long-range brain waves of deep sleep will move memory packets, recent experiences, from a short-term storage site, which is fragile, to a more permanent and thus safer long-term storage location. We therefore consider waking brainwave activity as that principally concerned with the reception of the outside sensory world, while the state of deep NREM slow-wave sleep donates a state of inward reflection, one that fosters information transfer and the distillation of memories. If wakefulness is dominated by reception, and NREM sleep by reflection, what then happens during REM sleep, the dreaming state?